Thank you. Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be here at KITP and in Santa Barbara. Yesterday I saw some dolphins out in the Pacific Ocean. It's really beautiful. The weather's always seemed to be pretty much perfect here, which is nice. So anyway, I'm going to talk about cosmic rays, as the title says. Cosmic rays, shocks, and plasma physics. And I took this course as a Blackboard talk, literally. I'm only going to use the Blackboard, no PowerPoint. It's really hard to do away with PowerPoint, but I'm going to try it. So I have to remember how to write. It's been a long time since I actually wrote on the board. So it may take me a while. So this is the title, and of course I may leave out a few details as I go along on these items. They're pretty big. But the first thing that we want to talk about is that cosmic rays were discovered 100 years ago. So the first question, why are cosmic rays still interesting? Still interesting and important. So, I mean, they've been around for a long time, they've been studied for a long time. Why are they still important? And there's a number of reasons. One, of course, cosmic rays contain the highest energy particles ever observed. The highest energy particles ever observed, up above 10 to the 20th electron volts in an individual particle. And this is more than 1,000 times as high as the LHC center of mass energy. So you have particles that will never be produced in man-made accelerators. And when these highest energy particles interact in the upper atmosphere, the nuclear physics that goes on there is not nuclear physics that can be investigated in the laboratory. The energies are way too high. Of course, the price you pay for this is that the fluxes are incredibly low. So we have to deal with that with cosmic rays. So that's one thing. Another thing that makes cosmic rays interesting is that they're the only source of matter from outside the solar system. Now, there are a few minor exceptions. We've collected a few dust grains from interstellar dust grains and so on. There are dust grains that you can extract from meteorites. And you say there's some other information, other matter from outside the solar system. But basically, cosmic rays are the main source of matter. And because of this, they convey information that you simply can't get from photons. Things like isotope ratios. So this is unique information that only cosmic rays can give you. And of course, isotope ratios are important signatures of nuclear synthesis, type 1a, type 2 supernovae produce particular isotope ratios. So we can get this information from cosmic rays and essentially no other. When cosmic rays were first discovered, and particularly 50 years ago or so, when it was realized that supernovae explosions were the most likely source of cosmic rays, the initial hope was that, hey, we could collect these particles at Earth. The particles were just made in a supernova. You could see nuclear synthesis in action. So this was one of the great... Pardon? Neutrinos. Yes, I forgot neutrinos. We've seen, 22 neutrinos or something, astrophysics. Yeah. Right, you're right. Okay. Okay, yes. So the other thing is that this business of particularly the isotope ratios is that we have the potential at least to see freshly synthesized material from supernova explosions in cosmic rays. It turns out that that's a lot harder than it seems, because after many years of observations, it became clear that the cosmic rays observed at Earth are mainly well-mixed ISM material, interstellar medium material. And there certainly is some signatures of fresh supernova ejecta. There's a neon 22 over neon 20 ratio that's observed in cosmic rays, which is considerably higher than the cosmic abundances. But the important point here is that cosmic rays do not yet show a very clear signature of fresh nuclear synthesis. But this, of course, is one of the areas in the future. There has to be a signature of freshly synthesized material in cosmic rays. It's just very likely at the 10% level or less, more sensitive observations are needed. So more sensitive observations. May show or may give us information on nuclear synthesis that...
So why did you say there has to be such a signature?
Okay, just a second. Let me write this out. Well, we believe that supernovae produce cosmic rays. The shocks from supernova remnants accelerate cosmic rays. So if that's the case, then there's a chance that the freshly synthesized material in the ejecta is going to be accelerated. We have this neon 22 ratio, which is anomalously high. This is clearly a signature of fresh synthesized material. So the point is that this is something that you have to look for. I mean, if you can see this, if you can see the isotope ratios that are clearly signatures of particular types of supernovae, that is giving us information on these instances. Yes?
Could you see them in time? Is the idea that you'd see a burst? Or?
No, the cosmic rays that we observe at Earth are averaged out over tens of millions of years.
What's the signature? What is the signature of nucleosynthesis?
Well, if a particular type of supernova, say a type 1a or a type 2, produces elements with abundances which are large compared to the well-mixed ISM. The well-mixed ISM contains the material that was there in the galaxy formed. It contains material from normal stars added to it by stellar winds, type 1a, type 2, all these different sources mixed together, and that we can identify. If you have a massive star, a core collapse supernova that goes off, it's going to produce particular elements in larger abundances. So if you can see and particularly isotope ratios that are anomalous. If you can see that in the cosmic rays, you can say, 80% of supernova are type 2 rather than type 1a.
But you can only get spatial time averages.
Yeah, this for the cosmic rays observed at Earth, this is averaged over tens of millions of years and over the region over which these cosmic rays propagate to us, certainly. Okay. So that's one reason. Another reason is that the non-thermal particles cosmic rays are actually important other than just that there are cosmic rays that we observed at Earth. For example, if we see radio emission, this is radio synchrotron, in a source like a radio jet or a supernova remnant, this radio synchrotron is being generated by relativistic electrons. These relativistic electrons are accelerated there. So the acceleration process producing these relativistic electrons may be similar to the acceleration process that produces cosmic rays. So understanding cosmic rays helps in understanding the acceleration of these electrons. And of course, radio emission is one of the major reasons we have for seeing some of these exotic sources outside the galaxy. Another reason, and I think this is important certainly for the work we're doing here, in some sources, non-thermal particles, accelerated particles, contain the majority of the energy. So So if you estimate the energy content in an extragalactic radio jet from the radiating relativistic electrons, the amount of energy in these accelerated non-thermal particles is a large fraction of the total, a supernova remnant. In the blast wave or a supernova remnant, there's strong evidence now that the cosmic rays that are accelerated in the outer shock contain a large fraction of the RAM energy of the explosion, 50% or more.
Okay.
Pardon?
I just said what large means.
Large means 50%. Which is, okay. And there are other reasons that cosmic rays are important. Cosmic rays have enough energy that as they diffuse through the interstellar medium, they can influence star formation. They affect molecular clouds and so on. By measuring the propagation properties of cosmic rays at the Earth, we learn things about the local space environment that we wouldn't be able to learn otherwise. Okay, and by the way, as is clear, make sure you ask questions as we go along, if you like. Okay, so that's kind of my introduction as to the rationale for why cosmic rays are still important. What I'm going to talk about now is some of the observations. So I'm going to look at the cosmic ray spectrum observed at Earth. Now, this is where my PowerPoint slide would have come in handy, but we're going to see what we can do here. So, okay, so I'm going to plot. This is a log-log plot. This is to help me get my scale right. So I'm going to, this is going to be energy. This is like 10 to the 9 electron volts, 10 to the 15th. 10 to the 20th, 20th. So I'm plotting the cosmic ray spectrum observed at Earth. This is flux over here, and it goes from about 10 to the minus 28th up here to about 10 to the 4th, and the cosmic ray spectrum looks something like the following.
Are the units of flux? Units of flux.
You need to refer to my PowerPoint slide for that. It's particles per cubic, particles per square centimeter per second. The absolute normalization here is not so interesting as the range. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. But the cosmic ray spectrum, and most people actually have seen this, it's kind of a famous spectrum. You have something that looks pretty much like a power law till you get to around 10 to the 15th, and then there's a slight, actually I'm exaggerating it here, softening of the spectrum. And then up around 10 to the 18th or 10 to the 19th is a very slight hardening, and then a cut off like that. So up here, it's approximately e to the minus 2.7. I hope you can see the red. Here it softens to about e to the minus 3. Power law here, there's this slight hardening and then this cutoff. And the famous regions here, this region of this change here is the knee, called the knee. Around 10 to the 15th electron volts. This region here is called the ankle. Then you have foot, toes, whatever you want. But anyway, I'm not going to worry about the second knee. There could be a second knee in here.
If you point in between the shin.
That's right. If you go up here, actually, the spectrum does this. It turns over, and this is because of solar modulation. In other words, the cosmic rays have to reach us at Earth. They have to fight their way against the solar wind, and this causes the low-energy particles to cut off. And that's actually interesting because in the interstellar medium, there has to be cosmic rays at even lower energy that simply don't make it up to us. So if you look at that, what you find is that you go from about 10 to the minus 28 up several orders of magnitude here, and you end up with approximately 40 decades of flux, which is really quite amazing over this whole cosmic ray spectrum. And I think you'd make the case that this is one of the most astounding single data sets in all of science, that you have 40 decades in flux for the cosmic rays. And you, by and large, if you don't look too closely, it's kind of a power law over this whole region. But the features, of course, are where the interest is. So you have this knee where something is happening, and you have the highest energies, which, of course, have a great deal of interest, because how do you put 10 to the 20th electron volts into a single proton? If you do this, actually it goes up to several times 10 to the 20th. I think three times 10 to the 20th EV is about the energy a baseball will have going about 70 miles an hour. This is a real energy for a single particle. Okay. And now, very relatively recently, this turnover here has been confirmed by Auger Observatory and Hi-Res, these two very large ground-based detectors. And this turnover is the GZK cutoff. Is there anybody here that doesn't know what GZK? I was hoping that wasn't the case. Okay. It's Grison, Zeppelin,
Kuzmin.
Kuzmin?
Yes.
Okay. Grison was an American, and Zeppelin and Kuzmin were Russians. And what happens here is that the universe, of course, is filled with 2.7 degree background photons. These extremely high energy particles, if they're coming from long distance away, will interact if they have high enough energy. And this cutoff was predicted since, I think, 1966, that the highest energy cosmic rays would turn over. And this is only recently, in the last 5 years or less, been really confirmed with these two very, very large ground-based instruments. Yes?
GZK, I can ask some dumb questions. One is, why would it turn over like that? And two is there any differentiation of which species, or are these just general flux?
Yes, the species is an extremely important question. And you said, why would it turn over that way? Or
yeah, why does GZK happen?
Because the assumption is that if you had one very powerful nearby source that produced high-energy cosmic rays, you'd see them. But the idea is that the cosmic ray sources for these energies are distributed. The closest source is some galaxy far away, so that they're coming from long distances away. And they simply have the longer they come, the more likely they are to interact. And this cutoff shows that these highest energy cosmic rays are coming from about within 100 million parsecs. And astronomers still use parsecs. One parsec is about 3 light years. So it's about 300 light years. Million light years. Yes?
What is thought to be the highest production energy?
Well, did you ask?
Well, that's why we're here. That's exactly. Yeah, there's two things, of course. The one is that you have these very highest energy particles. The other thing, what is capable of producing them? And it's not at all clear. We're going to, in this program, we're looking at shock acceleration, acceleration of particles at shocks. And what you find when you start looking at this is that a shock, say, in an extragalactic radio jet, you can estimate the parameters, is going to have a hell of a time producing cosmic rays up to that energy. Maybe up to 10 to the 18th or 10 to the 19th.
But it's only a factor of a million from the Planck scale.
Yeah, it's very, very high. And of course, that's. But we have another question here, and that is this knee, because the knee, you see another turnover here. And what almost certainly is taking place is that from here in, you have galactic cosmic rays produced within the Milky Way. From here out, it's certainly extragalactic. We don't know the source, but we know that you can't produce those in the galaxy. There's this transition region, of course, where there's going to be a mix, which is uncertain. But one of the hopes, of course, is that if the acceleration process is similar in the shocks in the galaxy, mainly supernova remnant shocks, and there's this turnover, maybe that's not so. Well, the GZK, of course, is different. That's a different thing that produces this. But maybe if you can understand these sources, it will help if you scale it up to galactic-sized sources there. That's one of the hope. And the composition comes in very critical. quickly here. Because in this turnover here, there's good indication in the observations that there's a change in the composition. Below that, cosmic rays, while they contain virtually all elements, they are predominantly protons. As you go into the knee, you start seeing hints of heavier elements taking over carbon, nitrogen, and then iron. And then when you get back up here again, there may be a change back to protons. You see there's hints of a similar change in composition at the very highest energy. So this is an extremely important diagnostic.
That's from protons to what?
In the knee? Protons to helium to iron. Iron is the thing. And most acceleration mechanisms accelerate particles proportional to their charge. So you can get 26 times as much energy to a proton, to an iron nucleus.
The other question, do you understand those exponents?
No, actually, we don't understand them in detail. We think we understand them reasonably well. The cosmic rays that you observe at Earth have propagated to us from their sources. And in the propagation, their spectrum, their source spectrum is softened. And of course, this again is a very complex and important process. This propagation involves a lot of parameters, a lot of models, and so on. But the idea is that the sources, and I'm only talking about the lowest energy particles here, above that, it's much less certain. The sources of the low energy cosmic rays produce something which is reasonably close to, let me put this in momentum, I'm sorry. Energy, that's okay. Something reasonably close to e to the minus 2, and then it's softened by propagation. But this, of course, this is a simplification. In fact, it's more complicated than that.
How precise is the scale?
Of what? Of the observations or the?
Those many are, I mean, that's a lot of, that's very impressive.
Yeah.
About going from e to the minus 2 to e to the minus 2.7?
No.
What?
You have 30 orders of magnitude.
Well, of course, if you plot it this way, the data looks nice, like there's nice smooth power laws and all this. In actual fact, the data is not that good. If you look at it in more detail, you find that there's a lot of uncertainty in this data. And this is because this data is incredibly hard to get. And this knee region, which is really interesting because it has a break, you have a change in composition, this knee is also the region where you go from one type of observation to a totally different observation. Below that, you can have direct observations with spacecraft or balloons where you actually measure cosmic ray nuclei. Above that, you have to go to indirect methods where you have large telescopes on the ground, looking at air Cherenkov or air showers, two totally different types of detection, and of course, matching them. And neither one of them is any good right here, of course, because that's that's where their range either ends or starts. And so the most interesting region is hardest to measure, and that's also the case at the very highest energies. The fluxes here are so incredibly low. One particle per square kilometer per century is the flux, typically, that it's just very, very difficult to get statistics. So, pardon?
Big detectors.
They have big detectors. They have these large ground-based detectors that have how many square kilometers, thousands of square? 3,000 square kilometers.
So. Can I add, the knee is already known for a very long time, right? I think the 60s or end of the 50s. So it's a very clear signature. I mean, there's no doubt that something like...
There's no doubt that something is taking place here. There's no doubt that you go from this to something like this. Understanding why there is a knee, understanding any compositional changes in here, understanding why you can have a break but then go to another presumably reasonably good power law is not understood.
Going back to an earlier question on the GPK, the detailed shape of that contains information about the character of the accelerators and the distribution over distance as well, and disentangling all of that is part of what you're interested in.
And another thing, of course, we can all count. So counting is very easy for the cosmic rays. It's just getting the energy right. So the shift is always in the horizontal direction instead of in the vertical direction. That's where the uncertainty comes.
And in fact, if you take this highest energy region here, and I'm just going to plot, say, 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 19th, 10 to the 20th electron volts, log scale, of course, and multiply this flux by e to the cubed, so that would be a line here. What you basically have is this ankle kind of comes in like this, then there's this presumably hardening of the spectrum, and then there's this GCK cutoff there. And 10 or 15 years ago, I'm not sure how long ago, there was hints that there were was actually observations of here, of cosmic rays, that would have been even higher than that, I think, here. And these particles, if they were real, these events create a tremendous amount of excitement because they were clearly above the GZK cutoff. And that implied that there might be some exotic sources of cosmic rays, like these exotic particles, these top-down sources. Now that these, and again, these were from a different detector altogether than the OJ and the high-res. And even though this looks like a tremendous difference here, a 20% change in energy normalization will shift these points over here, basically, because the spectrum is so steep. Yes?
So being worked by the E cubed factor.
Yeah.
I'm confused whether the flux you're plotting is an energy per unit time, per unit area, or a number of particles.
This is number of particles. Yeah. Number of particles.
Perhaps to rephrase David's question of a couple of minutes ago. So being technical in this matter of physics, right? Where we see these power law behaviors and they extend over two or three decades. I guess in our branch, it's like we are trained to search for a mechanism producing scale invariance. It can be like a second order phase decisions, it can be self-organized criticality. So how are you guys thinking about it? You know, just by fooling around with all kinds of accidents, I learned to get very skeptical.
No, that's exactly what I'm going to talk about now. There's a mechanism that naturally produces power loss.
We believe what Fermi told us long ago.
That's right. I'm going to get to that. Okay, I just want to, one other point. Oh, yeah, I wanted to make one more point. As I said, exotic sources were implied by these events. These events are now basically, you don't have to worry about them. The GCK cutoff is confirmed. So now we're limited to non-exotic sources like supermassive black holes rotating maximally and so on and so forth. So even the non-exotic sources are pretty exotic for producing these highest energy cosmic rays. Okay.
I think it is important to mention also in this part maybe that the understanding of cosmic rays, normal cosmic rays, will help to understand the geologic features from dark matter, possible dark matter decays, etc.
Well, that's one of the themes of our program, I think, or certainly in my mind, is that even though these may be considered the most exotic, you really have to look at the spectrum as a whole. If you can't understand the low energy ones, it's hopeless to understand the high. And in fact, we don't understand the lowest energy cosmic rays fully yet. And certainly, understanding things like how cosmic rays propagate in the local ISM, they produce a gamma ray background, which is important for dark matter searches and so on. So there's a lot of other features that. Okay, let me go on here. I guess I'm using the wrong slide. Okay. I see you lose your skills. Oh, yes. Yes, you do. Okay. If it takes me more than three times, then you know there's a problem. Okay. Now, so, what's the origin of cosmic rays? And the point here is trying to get a larger piece of chalk, okay? Yeah. So this, of course, is an important question. What are the main clues to the origin of cosmic rays. Well, the main clue, first of all, we have the spectrum, the cosmic rays that are measured at Earth, so we have the spectrum. We have the composition. And that's not shown in this plot. Basically, what's being plotted here is the all particle, all the cosmic rays summed together. But cosmic rays contain protons. They contain virtually all the elements in the periodic table. They contain electrons and so on. And everybody here also knows that lithium, beryllium, and boron are made almost totally in cosmic rays, right? 90% of the lithium, virtually all the beryllium and boron are made in cosmic rays as secondary particles and so on. So, spectrum and composition are clues. Another important clue is that we have direct evidence for the production of relativistic particles, TeV particles, acceleration of TeV particles in supernova remnants. There's absolutely no doubt that TeV, that hundreds of TeV particles are produced in supernova remnant shocks. Now, whether or not they're electrons or protons is still an important question, but there's no doubt that there are TeV particles produced in supernova remnant shocks. Okay, so the basic question in my mind, the basic question for the origin is what objects have enough total energy to power cosmic rays, and if you integrate over the cosmic ray spectrum, taking into account propagation, cosmic rays contain a lot of energy in the galaxy. So what objects have enough total energy, and what objects can accelerate individual particles to cosmic ray energies? Okay, and that limits the number of sources. And again, now I'm talking almost everything I say now for the rest of the talk will be restricted to basically cosmic rays below the knee. Okay, these two requirements really limit the sources in our Milky Way galaxy that can produce cosmic rays. And the most likely source, for a number of reasons, are supernova remnants. Okay. There are other sources. They certainly have enough total energy. I'm going to describe how we think that they can accelerate particles to high energies and so on. There are other sources that contain energy. Pulsars certainly contain a lot of energy. But the composition requirements for cosmic rays make pulsars less likely as a source for the vast majority of cosmic rays below 10 to the 15th electron volts. Okay, so that's the question. How do you accelerate particles? And that's what we want to talk about now. So, how do you accelerate particles? Well, there are a number of ways in astrophysics that we can do this. One is magnetic reconnection. Almost certainly works in solar flares and the high magnetic fields on the sun. Pulsar mechanisms, another possible way of accelerating particles. We know this works, of course. We see very energetic particles associated with pulsar wind nebula and so forth. The second order Fermi mechanism and this is from his Fermi's 1949 paper. This is the one that most school kids learn in school, where you have these clouds in space going at random speeds and cosmic rays bounce between them and get energies. And I heard a story about this years and years ago, which may or may not be true, but it's a good story anyway. And that is that back in 1949, Al Fain, very famous scientist, of course, was trying to convince everybody that all cosmic rays were produced in the sun, which even 1949 was pretty non-crackpot. And Fermi went to one of his talks with Al Fain, who's going through all these double layers and everything that are going to produce these cosmic rays in the sun. And the story goes that Fermi walked out and said, I can do better than that in 5 minutes, and sat down and wrote his 1949 paper with the clouds. Unfortunately, it was seen almost immediately that Fermi's idea was wrong. There's no way that the second order Fermi mechanism as described in 1949 could produce the cosmic rays that we observed. There are some technical reasons, acceleration of protons versus heavies and so on. And eventually Fermi published his paper associated with shocks in 1954, just shortly before he died, where he took his mechanism and converted it to thought about the idea that maybe shocks could help here. So this is the first order Fermi mechanism.
Does he actually mention shocks in that paper?
I don't think he did.
I think he mentioned shocks. He talked about somehow you have to arrange for the flows to be all converging. And I think he mentioned shocks. Converging clouds? He did not mention shocks. Okay. Okay, well, it's been a long time since I looked at that paper. I actually did, but I don't remember that. Okay, but anyway, the idea is that there's a second order Fermi mechanism, a first order Fermi mechanism, and I explain why shocks work really nicely for the first order Fermi mechanism. Okay, so what we're going to say is that four, even though these other mechanisms certainly take place, it's very likely now that the mechanism for producing cosmic rays is the first order Fermi mechanism. In collisionless shocks. And I'm going to abbreviate this as diffusive shock acceleration. Actually, wasn't it Morrison who debunked the 1949 paper, basically, Phil Morrison? Yeah. Okay.
Very stupid question. You can look at this as like the earthly accelerator builders could perhaps learn from astrophysics, right, how to build better LHC. Now, my understanding is that our colleagues are thinking about laser wake acceleration. Is there anything in astrophysics that could be like that?
I didn't put that on the list. That's certainly something that's being done in simulations and in the lab. My personal feeling is that it's not likely to be a strong candidate in astrophysics.
It's hard to make things with that much coherence.
Yeah, you don't have that in astrophysics.
I think you might.
Not impossible. It's hard.
Do they provide a mechanism, or do you include those mechanisms?
Well, active galactic nuclei certainly provide a source for producing very strong shocks in the radio jets, or the jets coming out of active galactic nuclei. You have these relativistic flows, which are going to interact with the intergalactic medium and almost certainly produce a bow shock at the end. This is.
But what about the Blanford-Zayac mechanism or something?
I think that mechanism is the mechanism for producing the ordered flow in the jet, right? That does not produce individual particles of very high energies. It produces an ordered flow. The trick is to go from that ordered flow containing all that energy into individual particle energy. What's the mechanism that does that? And there are other ways of doing it, but a shock is a natural way of doing it.
You also have to get into a power law somehow. So there's that.
Okay. So,
just to produce some truth in advertising here, there's a class of people who are very interested in things like these, in the Blanford-Zayac mechanism, a very magnetized jet. which the magnetic energy is dominant. Within such things, it's hard to make a shock as an efficient accelerator. And the people who are interested in that as a way to do the acceleration then appeal to the top of Don's list of some variation on magnetic dissipation. And when you do that, you get a time-changing magnetic field, you get large voltages, and there's a lot of talk about producing it. To be then fair to the current discussion, the people who advocate that have yet to demonstrate any clear way of getting this out, at least without a lot of complicated hand-waving.
So, thank you, John, and welcome to
summer. Okay. So John's certainly right. I'm going to talk from now on about collisionless shocks solely, and this does not mean that that this is absolutely rock solid. There are other mechanisms, but this is what I'm going to talk about. And there are some reasons for picking this over other mechanisms, and this is what I'm going to talk about now. I'm going to tell you what a collision shock is in a second, but first I'm going to tell you that shocks are common in astrophysics. And this is very important, because the simple fact that you have very low densities and very easily can arrange for high bulk speeds, it's very easy to get supersonic flows in astrophysics, and you see shocks in very many places. And something as gentle as the solar wind, our sun's solar wind, has a sonic Mach number of 5 to 10. So it's very highly supersonic, and this is just a gentle wind, basically. So it's very easy to shock. Shocks are common. Shocks in astrophysics, in diffuse regions in astrophysics, are collisionless. And what that means is that particle-particle collisions are unimportant. Particle-particle collisions are unimportant, and the particles are tied together by magnetic field interactions. And this is incredibly important, because if you have particle-particle collisions in dense material, these are inelastic. Anytime one particle happens to get a little bit extra energy, it immediately hits a slower one and shares its energy. You get thermal distributions. With magnetic field interactions, basically you have a charged particle which is interacting with magnetic field. So you have one proton which is basically interacting with Avogadro's number of particles tied together with magnetic field. So the interactions to a reasonable degree are elastic. So you can produce and maintain non-thermal distributions easily, and they can persist for long times. That's a fundamental difference. And it also is a fundamental problem in some regards, because collisionless plasmas, in my opinion, are almost impossible to produce in the laboratory. And therefore, we can't resort, in my opinion, to realistic lab experiments of collisionless plasmas. So you are left with space observations. We have shocks in the heliosphere that have been measured by in situ spacecraft, and you have computer simulations.
What's the obstacle to making in the lab?
Lab plasmas are always collision dominated.
It's not true, Don.
Well,
it's really not true, no.
It's a question of time, I guess. How long can they remain collision?
It's realistic about shocks in the lab. Collision shock in the lab is very hard. And right. That's absolutely true, but there are plenty of examples of collisionless plasmas for other purposes. So.
It's hard to maintain a collisionless plasma, I think, for a long period of time.
Long is always with respect to the process you want to measure.
Right.
And that you can certainly do.
Okay, I may have overstated that. I'm not going to deny that.
And it's just the low density, right?
It's the low density that really does it to you.
Yeah.
And it's extremely low by lab. Okay, now another thing that's important for shocks is that Essentially, again, this may be a slightly overstatement, but shocks, astrophysical shocks, are always seen to be associated with non-thermal particle populations. There are many shocks. We have shocks in the heliosphere. We have the bow shock, the solar wind hitting the Earth, interplanetary shocks, solar wind termination shock. Those are absolutely directly measured by spacecraft. Energetic particles are associated with them, no doubt. We have supernova remnant blast waves, which we believe is a shock, certainly a collision shock. Very indirect, but very, very clear evidence associated with them, and so on and so forth. And I think this separates some of these other mechanisms. The fact that there's clear, undeniable evidence that you have particle acceleration taking place nearby or by shocks. Okay. And the last thing is that we have this now well-defined mechanism for accelerating particles, and that is diffusive shock acceleration. And I want to talk about that now. And this, the test particle theory of diffusive shock acceleration, going well beyond what Fermi did in 1954, was written down in by four, as far as I can tell, independent papers. Krimsky, 76, in Russian. Axford, Lear, and Skadron, 77. Blanford and Allstriker, 78. And Bell, 78. Ah, can't write. And as far as I can tell, I mean, I may be wrong, that none of these people really knew that the others had done it. And they're all, in some ways, totally different derivations of what I'm going to show you next, the test particle power law. And all about the same time, clearly, this idea was ready to happen at that point. And some people here actually may know more about that than I do, David certainly, but I think that's right. And so this was really, and of these people, I think Krimsky's still working actively, right, Andre? He was until recently. Blanford, of course, is whenever he gets time, still thinks about shock acceleration. And Tony Bell is very active in the field now. And actually, we'll be at our conference, I believe, at the end. So this is still, now that may tell you that all these people are exceptionally slow to get something done, but that's probably not the correct answer to it. It's a hard problem. Okay. So what is shock acceleration? Diffusive shock acceleration. Well, we have this test particle result. And by the way, there were a lot of other people working in this field at the time, mainly cosmic rays certainly, but also a lot of spacecraft observations in the heliosphere. A lot of people were working at that. The following test particle result just wasn't obvious. So you have diffusive shock acceleration. The test particle result that comes out of all these derivations is that if you have a shock, a collision is shock, where you can assume that the particle interactions are elastic, so you have upstream flow, I'm in the shock frame, you have a downstream flow, so U0 over U2 is equal to the compression ratio of the shock in the very simplest geometry. If you have a charged particle that is able to diffuse back and forth across the shock many times, every time it crosses the shock, and this is where Fermi's 54 paper comes into play. He said if you could arrange for some type of converging situation, say clouds coming towards each other, this is exactly what a shock does for you. You have these two plasmas that are basically converging between upstream and downstream. A charged particle called in between will scatter back and forth elastically because it's a collisionless plasma. Every time it crosses the shock, it gains energy. The magic, the mystery of this first order Fermi mechanism, of the of this paper here, is that it was realized that every time a particle crosses the shock, it gains some velocity, delta U, from the converging flows, just like a baseball hitting a moving wall. So that it has to cross the shock n times to gain a particular energy. But every time it ends up downstream, it has a probability of being lost downstream, convected downstream. So if it crosses the shock n times, it gains a certain energy. But there's a certain probability to cross n times, which decreases with the number of n. When you fold these two together, you get a power law. And this was the amazing thing. You get a power law in momentum proportional to, this is a phase-based distribution, minus 3R, R minus 1. R is the compression ratio, a power law with a single parameter for the index, which was amazing. But even more amazing is that if you look at strong shocks, and most shocks in astrophysics are strong. The solar wind is a Mach number of 5 or 10. If you look at strong shocks, you find that the compression ratio for a strong test particle shock is approximately 4. You plug that in, P to the minus 4, or if you translate to energy, E to the minus 2 for relativistic particles. And now if I hadn't erased my plot of the cosmic ray spectrum, I told you that once you take into account propagation, the e to the minus 2.7 goes to approximately e to the minus 2. People saw that. We have a mechanism which, with zero parameters, gives us a power law, e to the minus 2. There it is. That was the answer. That's why everybody thought this was great. So this is the so-called universal power law from Fermi shock acceleration.
Question.
Yes.
Stupid question. So the plasma is supposed to be collisionless.
Yes.
The particle is part of that plasma.
Yes.
And now you say that the particle is really very strongly diffused and it can go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And that appears to me as kind of a paradox because diffusion is like collision full. What's going on?
I think you're thinking in terms of a thermal plasma. Well, that obviously can't happen. But in a non-thermal collisionless plasma, once a particle gains an energy, it keeps that energy.
Yeah, exactly.
And it can gain more and keep that. Relative to
diffuse back and forth.
Collisions aren't off on the particle, maybe that's...
Pardon?
It's
not Coulomb collisions.
No, these are not... No, I didn't tell you that collisions. I have to tell you. Yeah, I have that. That's another 3 or 4 hours I'll get to that. Okay. I will tell you that. Okay, how much time do I have? 1:30, I guess. Okay, let me keep going here quickly. Okay, now, yeah, I have to talk about the collisions here. Right, these collisions are against, not against particles, but against magnetic turbulence.
Okay.
So, and the trick here, there's a couple tricks. The first trick is that this magnetic turbulence, so this is, let's call this delta B over B, the magnetic turbulence must be self-generated in the shock. Now you can say, okay, you can start off with some background turbulence, that's true. But if you want to accelerate particles to high energies and apply cosmic rays, you have to generate turbulence that is resonant with the particles. So it has to be self-generated. Okay, that's one thing. And then the other thing is that if you looked at this spectrum here, this is number of particles proportional to e to the minus 2. If you integrate this from 0 to infinity, you find out that it diverges. So this spectrum is right on the cusp of a convergent energy or divergent energy, and it becomes clear that this cannot hold if you accelerate particles to very high energies. Because if you get to relativistic particles and you have enough pressure in relativistic particles, they change the ratio of specific heats of the gas. That changes the compression ratio. So the compression ratio now becomes greater than 4 if you produce relativistic particles. That means that this spectrum becomes harder than e to the minus 2, which means that your energy the fact that you don't conserve energy gets even worse. So it's clear that you have to do something with this. The test particle result was thought to be very good, but the test particle result is only good if the number of particles produced is tiny, so that they contain an insignificant fraction of the energy. And that is not going to work. Okay. So, and now what we found, and since 19, in the last 30-some years, what most people in this field have been doing is trying to generalize this test particle result to the case where shock acceleration is efficient and nonlinear. And that makes everything hard. And there is, in fact, very clear evidence. There's clear evidence, not just our ideas, but there are very clear evidence that shock acceleration is efficient. We have direct evidence that the Earth's bow shock, this little shock around the Earth, puts 25% of the solar wind ram energy into superthermal particles. There's evidence that supernova remnant shocks and so on, that it is efficient. And in fact, as long as this assumption of elastic collisions against the background holds, you can go to 99%. I don't say 100 because it doesn't make any sense, but you can go to essentially 100% efficiency. Now, at some point, your assumptions are going to break down. If you do have to generate magnetic turbulence, you have to take particle energy, put it in background turbulence. This is going to reduce the efficiency. But the bottom line, shock acceleration wants to put all of the energy into relativistic particles. It's intrinsically extremely efficient mechanism. And once you do that, everything gets hard. Okay. So, if you assume that delta B over B is small, as was done initially, so you just have this, and now let me talk about the scattering a little bit here. So how do you scatter particles? Okay, you start off with, say, you start off with a uniform magnetic field. You have a particle that's gyrating around it, like this, a proton or whatever. This particle is going to perturb the field slightly, so now the field becomes like this. So the next proton that comes along is going to basically gyrate, but now it's going to pitch angle scatter. And it would create more turbulence. If the turbulence gets strong enough, this particle is going to actually turn around in pitch angle scattering. And now you can define a mean free path for scattering, quote unquote, off of this background magnetic field, which is basically elastic. So the point is that, and this is, you can see the source of the problem. The particles produce the turbulence. The turbulence then scatters the particles. The particles are then accelerated. You now have more accelerated particles. You now have more turbulence being produced. So the process is intrinsically, there's this intrinsic feedback that makes the thing complicated. And originally they said, okay, this is fine as long as delta B over B is small. We can use quasi-linear theory, which is just perturbation techniques, for describing the production of the turbulence. Once you have the production of the turbulence, you can calculate a diffusion coefficient, you can put it in the equations, everything's fine. And quasi-linear theory was originally stretched to delta B over B equal to 1. So now you have, that's already stretching the field. And at this point, the gyro radius of the particle generating the turbulence becomes approximately equal to the mean free path of scattering. And this is the so-called Bohm diffusion limit. Okay, and that's where things stood for quite a while until, how long ago, 10 years ago? When was the first clear observations that magnetic fields and supernova remnants were much higher? Actually, it goes back further than that to Kausik, but the But this was fine, and then you can have this production of the turbulence. You can accelerate particles efficiently. Once the particles are accelerated efficiently, you have to include the feedback of the cosmic ray pressure on the shock structure. I'm not going to go into the details on that, but that's very important. So everything has to work out so you don't get over 100% efficient, obviously. And you can include all these things in. But the thing that happened relatively recently, and the thing that really prompted this workshop or this program here, is that it became reasonably clear from observations of young supernova remnants that the magnetic field, or at least the turbulence in the magnetic field, was much larger than one. So that the turbulent magnetic field associated with the particles radiating electron or radio synchrotron or even TeV emission was such that the magnetic field in the supernova outer blast wave here was maybe 10, maybe 100 times the ambient ISM field. And this was really amazing, because everything depends on the magnetic field. The efficiency of the acceleration depends on, perhaps more importantly, the maximum energy that you can produce in a shock depends on the magnetic field, because everything scales as a magnetic field. Higher field, faster accelerate, the smaller the scale you can accelerate the particles in. So everything depends on the magnetic field, and lo and behold, we found from observations that the fields were 10, maybe 100 times larger than just the compressed field. Now, maybe you remember, Dave, but I don't remember anybody predicting this 30 years ago.
Because it was not 30 years ago.
What?
It's been the observational estimates from supernova remnants of 100 times the galactic value are around longer than any theory.
Well, Kausik did it in 82.
What?
He estimated it in 82.
No, but people had it estimated before that.
Okay.
I mean, they were rough estimates, but it was always a few times 10 to the minus. It was always about 100 times the galactic field. And nobody knew where it came from, and we still don't. But
that certainly wasn't the value that Lagage and Czarski used in their 82, 83 papers.
I guess it's sort of common equipartition fields that people were estimating 20 years ago were always.
Right, but equipartition is just totally ad hoc, completely ad hoc.
But the numbers are always out there.
Yes, but the idea was always that it was generated inside the supernova remnant, not in the shock front, right? For Cas8, it was sort of this layer between the ejecta and the swept up interstellar medium that sort of had instabilities and would wind up the magnetic field. It was nothing at the shock front.
Look, if you didn't have high magnetic fields, you would have to pay the price in higher electron energies. So it was really hard to get around it.
Yeah.
And in fact, in 1982, when we had a workshop right here, well, in Ellis and Paul back then, on the same topic, it was also discussed, how the hell do you get large magnetic fields? And nobody really knew.
Okay. Well, hopefully that's what we're going to answer in this program. You have a question?
Yeah, just maybe terminology. When you say a turbulent,
Pardon?
You use the word turbulence.
Yes.
For the magnetic field. Is that, are you speaking metaphorically, or is it literally a turbulence? What does that mean?
Well, I'm speaking literally. The field is, I mean, you can imagine, you can imagine a simple model where you have L-Fang waves superimposed on a uniform field, but really the field becomes turbulent. I mean, it's highly...
It's not clear that it's isotropic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah. And that, in fact, we have direct observations of that at heliospheric shocks and so on. Yes?
If the particle goes in and affects the magnetic field, which affects the particle back and forth, how do you classify these as inelastic collisions? I mean, it's completely...
Well, it won't be completely inelastic then.
Completely elastic.
Well,
it's elastic, and it seems like there's a lot of interaction with the field. So,
yes.
And that seems like an important point.
Exactly. Yeah, if you start producing magnetic fields like this, you are transferring energy from the particles to the background field. So it's no longer completely elastic. Absolutely.
But isn't that important to this... You had to assume that they were elastic collisions at some point.
Yes, you now have to do the, you can't do the test particle calculation anymore. You now have to include the feedback of the cosmic rays in the shock structure. The feedback of the magnetic pressure also becomes important on the shock structure. It becomes a much more complicated problem. And all these things now become, but again, the process wouldn't start at all if initially it wasn't nearly elastic with the background. Yes.
So you've lost the test particle.
Test particle is gone.
So you've lost the understanding of the spectrum.
A cynic might say that, actually. But actually, it's so much richer now. We have so much more information. Remember, a test particle, a power law contains virtually no information whatsoever. So we're now in a much... Okay, yes, yes. So unfortunately, what I'm, all these words that I've been saying here, talking about turbulence and magnetic field and this feedback, really what I'm talking about is plasma physics. And most astrophysicists did not sign on to do plasma. Right. So now things are...
Well, to run the other way as fast as
exactly.
We can.
I mean, and this is the situation we're in now. We have our tools, which are basically quasi-linear theory, which assumes delta B over B is small. We know that that's not the case. We know that the observations are telling us this. So what do? We have very efficient acceleration, which tells us that everything is nonlinear, production of particles, production of fields. This becomes very complicated. So what we're going to have to do is and we can't resort to lab experiments for shocks. And spacecraft experiments would be great in the heliosphere. The problem with that is that all the shocks in the heliosphere are basically weak, much weaker than the supernova remnant shock. They don't pick up and accelerate thermal protons or thermal electrons to relativistic energies. Solar flares can, but not the in-situ shock. So even spacecraft observations are not so good. So what we really have to deal with now are approximate models, and computer simulations. Okay, and I'm almost finished here. So that's what this workshop is basically about. We have the most complete computational tool that you could have, really, are particle and cell simulations. Pick simulations. Here you just take a simulation box, you put protons and electrons in it, a background magnetic field, let the particles scatter, solve Maxwell's equations, everything's done. You're finished, okay. What you find out almost instantly is that this is a lot easier said than done, and the reason is because of two basic problems. One, the shock acceleration, if we're talking about shocks, intrinsically has a tremendously wide dynamic range, both in momentum and space. If we're going to accelerate particles up to even 10 to the 15th EV from 1 keV, you have this tremendous range in energy. You have to follow that particle. 10 to the 15th EV particles have a diffusion length, which is many orders of magnitude longer than the thermal keV particles. So you have to follow that. So it has tremendous dynamic range. And the other thing that really kills you is that because it's efficient and because it's nonlinear, and because now we have a spectrum, which is hard, a hard spectrum. And by hard, remember the power law result was the following. You have a thermal, shock heated thermal gas. You now have a, let me multiply this by P to the 4. So the test particle P to the minus 4 would be flat here. The test particle result is that you just come in at some level where this is very, very far below the thermal, so there's no energy here. But nonlinear, what happens is that the spectrum, first of all, has to be normalized properly with the thermal particles. It has this concave curvature in it. You go to higher energies where the spectrum becomes harder than this p to the minus 4, and then you have to cut it off. You have to follow everything here. And this hard portion of the spectrum where it's harder than p to the minus 4 means that this is where all your energy ends up. This is where the energy is. So you have energy in thermal, energy in the highest energies, little in between. And what that tells you is that the pressure from the highest energy particles influences the injection and acceleration of the lowest energy particles. So you have to go to the highest energies before you know what's happening with the lowest energies. So that means that injection versus Emax has to be done. And this makes it extremely hard for PIC simulations. Nevertheless, PIC simulations are the only way that you can really understand and go after the real plasma physics. So that is where a lot of emphasis is. And then I'm going to almost finish here. So then, of course, we have to do approximate methods, and we have a lot of people here are doing approximate methods where you have to compromise. You have to take as input the diffusion coefficient or some of the plasma physics, put it in your model, do the nonlinear effects, and then see what turns out. And the saving grace here, so we have approximate methods, is, let me end up over here. This is my final comment. So the reason we hope that we may be able to make some progress on this very, very complicated problem is that once you have your nonlinear spectrum like this, then the entire spectrum has to be calculated self-consistently. That's hard. But now the photon emission from the entire spectrum constrains the whole model. So you have emission from the highest energies. You have inverse Compton at TeV range. You have radio synchrotron from GeV electrons. These same electrons produce X-ray synchrotron emission. The thermal particles produce thermal X-ray emission. We have telescopes that look at thermal Chandra, radio, of course, the highest energy particles. So in principle, we can constrain our models with observations. We can explain observations with our models, hopefully. One thing you may have noticed is that this spectrum that I plotted here is the electron spectrum. Electrons radiate, which is nice. If this is a momentum spectrum here, and this will be MC approximately, of course, there's protons there as well. And the protons, actually, if this were the electrons, the proton spectrum would look something like this. The electrons radiate. The protons, the best you can hope for are proton-proton collisions, which produce pi zero, which produce gamma rays. And these gamma rays from the protons are produced at exactly the same energy as the inverse Compton photons from the electrons. Electrons radiate. There's no doubt that they're in supernova remnants. However, most shock theories predict that you put maybe 100 times as much energy into the unseen protons as you do in the electrons, which are easy to see. Okay, that's where I'm going to stop.
Okay, any more questions?